Hi, Tiny Matters listeners. Sam here. We have a super fun episode for you today that has our favorite combo of things: interesting science, fascinating history, important societal context, and a sprinkle of goofiness. Our guests are Trace Dominguez and Julian Huguet, the hosts of the podcast That's Absurd, Please Elaborate, where they do serious research to typically answer very silly questions.
And before we get into the show, we have a quick request. We would be so grateful if you could take a minute now or after the episode to rate and review us. It helps so much. And at least a couple of podcast apps now automatically stop downloads if you don't have phone space or haven't listened recently. So go double check that you're still subscribed and getting our episodes every other Wednesday. Okay, that is enough housekeeping. Let's get into the episode. We think you're gonna love it.
I'm Julian Huguet. I have been a science communicator for 10 years, working mostly for Discovery Digital's YouTube channel, DNews, and then later Seeker.
I'm Trace Dominguez. I'm a science communicator. I've been one now for 12 years, and I worked for Discovery News, Seeker, and now I host a show for PBS about medical research called Research Detectives, and another one about astronomy called Stargazers.
And we together host a show called That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. And Trace had to one-up me as a science communicator for 12 years.
Yeah, watch out.
Ooh.
You threw in the years. We could have just both been science communicators, but you started the competition.
I wanted to have a minimum of a decade of experience so people know.
Yeah, when you guys like get in a debate over something, is it like, I've got two years
on you.
It does feel a little bit like twins being like, you know, I'm older.
Yeah, by 3 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, perfect.
Well, we're super psyched that you guys are joining us. Can we hear a little bit about That's Absurd, Please Elaborate? Because we both love the show. We think our listeners would love the show. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah. We've always wanted to explore podcasts and having these like longer form pieces. And we know how to do this science communication research. So eventually we kind of came to, what if we just asked silly questions and tried to do the science?
Yeah.
And see if there's any there.
So every other week, we have an episode where each of us goes and researches a silly question from a listener, and then we come back and we just present it to the other one, and it's a blast. And we get to have fabulous guests on as well.
That's right.
If it wasn't clear, Sam and DeBokey are going to be guests in upcoming episodes.
I think some of my favorite questions we've gotten to answer have almost all come from just some random person who sent us a question. One of our early questions, what if the whole world were more sheep than people?
Incredible.
Was really fun. That one was really good.
I had to do a lot of math.
What if you plugged a volcano with concrete? Mm-hmm. It was really fun. Mm-hmm. We got from a five-year-old, how long would it take to make a Lego replica of the sun?
Wow.
That was fun because I had to figure out like how many Lego pieces we make in a year and then how many Lego pieces it would take to build a full-size sun. We're almost a year into the podcast now, which is really exciting. We've done like 30 episodes. That's really cool.
Nice. If you guys are game, I would love to hop into today's topic. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the question that, what should I say, stemmed today's episode?
Good pun.
The question that germinated this episode?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Excellent. A guy named Brian wrote in and wrote, my uncle presented me with a question that he and his friends came up with during a night at the local bar.
Love
he
it.
Thought it was the funniest question ever. Who invented lawns?
I picture a bunch of half-drunk dudes in their 40s at a bar, and they're like, I just realized something. Someone must have invented the lawn, right?
Yes. Yeah. I picture a bunch of people in New Balances, like just very meme dads, right? They're all in New Balances that are green, stained green from all the lawn mowing.
Yeah.
It's just talking about lawns like you do.
Yeah.
So we put together an answer to this that goes all the way back to the beginning of grass. So if you want, we can start there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I love it.
Julian, do you want to tell them about how grass started?
When he says beginning, Trace is the one who tackled this question, and Trace hit me with this. He's like, let's go back to the Cretaceous period, 140 million years ago. So in the Cretaceous, you have yourself some dinosaurs, you have some trees, You've got algae, but try as you might, look far and wide, there is no grass yet. It's all just covered in ferns and mosses. You don't start seeing grasses until about anywhere from 80 to 66 million years ago. It's at the end of the Cretaceous before dinosaurs disappear, and then we get grass. And the reason grass starts coming about, the thing that makes it different, is it goes through photosynthesis in a different way. Instead of using C3 photosynthesis, which about 85% of plants today use, grass uses C4 photosynthesis. Do you want me to elaborate on the differences?
Yes, please.
We love an elaboration on Tiny Matters.
So there's this thing called photosynthesis. It's it's what plants use to turn light energy from the sun into chemical energy, and it stores it in sugar, right? In a 6-carbon sugar called glucose. But part of that process is called the Calvin cycle. The Calvin cycle uses an enzyme called Rubisco. It takes CO2, it attaches it to a 5-carbon molecule, and that kicks off the whole process that ends with a 6-carbon glucose. But the problem with Rubisco is sometimes instead of taking CO2, it grabs oxygen, and this is called photorespiration, and it lowers the efficiency of photosynthesis. Sometimes you're just not getting as much of that tasty, great sugar that you're trying to make if you're a plant. Well, C4 photosynthesis that grass uses splits up parts of this cycle, and it first takes CO2 and sticks it on something to make a 4-carbon molecule, and that gets adjusted a little bit, and then it gets shipped to an entirely different cell in the plant. And there, it's all CO2. There's none of that oxygen that can get in the way and mess things up. And Rubisco can then take it and turn it into what it needs to. So it wastes a little bit of energy shuffling stuff back and forth, but it's more efficient in terms of actually making glucose.
Yeah, that's so cool. Grass was a pretty big deal for evolution, if you will, or for the evolution of plants.
Mm-hmm. It's it uses C4 photosynthesis. It's good for hotter, drier climates. It's great in dry soil. You don't need a trunk like a tree. It just sticks right out of the ground, your little photosynthesizing blades.
Yeah, it's basically like a root with leaves on it, as opposed to like roots, trunk, leaves. It's just roots, leaves. You kind of cut out the middle.
Keep it simple.
Bit.
Keep it simple. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, keep it simple.
So today there's about 10,000 different species of grass. You might not even realize it. Bamboo is grass. Rice, wheat, rye, oats, corn, barley, and sugarcane. Those are all examples of grasses.
Did not know sugarcane.
Oh, interesting. So when we look at a cornfield, we're looking at a lawn.
Yeah, kind of.
If you choose to see it
if you
that
want
way.
To think of it that way, sure.
Yeah.
What a beautiful lawn. America's lawn. When you're driving through Iowa and all you see is America's lawn. So then once grass evolves, it obviously has this more efficient photosynthesis. It also can be spread on the wind, and that means it can colonize rocky areas and hard to reach spots. But it also means that it can change the landscape more easily. It doesn't need to spread like a tree where it just drops, you know, an acorn or a pine cone or something like that. It can just spread far and wide. And that means that the landscape changes over time. So today, a third of the planet is grassland, prairies and steppe savannas. And animals are able to then go and eat those plants anywhere that those grasses grow, including mountainsides, which previously trees had trouble growing on, or ferns needed more water, and so they couldn't do that. So if you fast forward millions of years, you know, humans and grasses have this nice kind of symbiosis. We're domesticating them for food, you know, as we mentioned, things like grains, and it's grown all over the world. So today we use it for bread and alcohol, obviously staple foods like rice. We have oats and sugars, and all of that is thanks to the grasses evolving. But that's not really related to lawns, but it is a nice benefit.
Yeah.
The lawn as we know it, though, it came out of this idea of a garden. And gardens, there's really two types of gardens. I used to work at a museum, and we had a working garden with herbs in it, and it was an educational system. You know, you could go out and show people, like, here's the herb we use for cooking, here's an herb we might use for medicine, here's an herb, you know, lamb's ear that we might put on a wound or something like that. So we can use these herbs for all sorts of things. If you're going to have land that you cultivate, if you think about it, you want it to be useful. You want it to be doing something. You're out there working it. And then if you were wealthy, you could essentially afford to have a pleasure garden, which it was land that you were paying to use and work, But you weren't getting anything out of it other than your own enjoyment, right? You weren't getting fruit, you weren't getting herbs, you weren't getting vegetable. And so that's where we sort of see the start of lawns, because we get these big trees, these cultivated plants, walls and paths and canals and things that when you think of kind of old world gardens, you can picture.
Hmm. Just a big flex of like, check out all the nothing I'm growing here, peasants. Yeah. So the question though was, who invented the lawn? And Trace, yeah, in his research, actually like went through the history of how pleasure gardens changed over time. And again, yeah, Trace being thorough, went far back to Pliny the Younger. He actually went farther than that. He went back to Homer's Iliad and Odyssey in the 8th century, yeah, BCE.
Got it. I thought it was going to be Pliny the Elder, but...
Oh, like, yeah, no, that guy buried by Mount Vesuvius. Yeah. He's, yeah.
He just... I think we can all agree that Pliny the Younger is a Nepo baby. So he just, you know, he just gets the benefits these days, yeah, now. True.
And what I love about Pliny the Younger, when Trace was telling me about this on our show, is he talks about his pleasure garden in a letter. And to me, it just sounded like a bunch of lies. It sounded like a flex where he's like, this is what Pliny the Younger says about his pleasure garden. He says, "You descend from the terrace by an easy slope adorned with the figures of animals in a box facing each other to a lawn overspread with the soft, I had almost said the liquid, acanthus. This is surrounded by a walk enclosed with evergreens shaped into a variety of forms." And to me, it's like, I just picture he's got a busted Chevy in the yard on cinder blocks. And he's like, oh, but my garden's wonderful.
So yeah. Yeah. Who's gonna know?
New home's great. I don't miss you all back in Rome or wherever, yeah, he's writing to. I don't know. But I just thought it was so funny. But again, we don't have an actual grass lawn yet. He mentions like walking on this acanthus plant. What exactly was that again, Trace?
It's like a ground cover.
Yeah.
It's funny that he calls it soft, like a soft, almost liquid.
Yeah.
But it's like a ground cover plant. My mom, the master gardener, could tell us more, but I don't know off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring her on.
At that point, I went into the research of, okay, well, where did we go from there? And we get to the Sakoteiki, which is a records of garden making, which is the oldest known text on garden planning. So they started to get that. That was in the 11th century. It's Japanese. And they talk a lot about how to arrange a garden. And they use stones and they use plants and they have different styles. But again, still... no grass. We're all the way into the 11th century, so we're getting pretty close to today, and there's still no lawn until, surprise, surprise, the colonizers arrived in the Americas.
Always a turning point.
Yeah. Yeah. So obviously there were landscapes similar to what I alluded to about corn. You know, they were tended by these first peoples, by these Native Americans, by these people living in North, Central, and South America. They were managing the wilderness. They were managing these landscapes just like any other society would. And so there were trails and roads and working gardens and orchards. They didn't have pastures for livestock because livestock weren't really native to the Americas when the Europeans showed up, but they did have landscapes for hunting and fishing. So they were using them in the way that they needed them to be used. And there were grasses in New England, but they were low nutrition grasses because they didn't support animals. And they would go dormant in the winter, which anyone on the East Coast of the U.S. knows. Your grass turns kind of that yellow brown. It doesn't mean it's dead. It's just dormant, waiting till summertime.
Actually, I didn't know that, which is so silly because of course, it's not like every lawn is regrowing fully every single year, but when I see a plant and it looks like so withered and brown, I just assumed it was dead and it's not. That is fascinating. All right.
I think that's pretty normal, right? Like we think of, we look at trees with no leaves in the summer and we're like, oh, that tree's not doing great. But if you know that they drop their leaves and you see that happen, but with grass, you don't, because it's just a leaf, it doesn't work the same way, right?
Right, yeah.
Fun fact about leaves, one of my favorite facts that I learned in any video I ever made, is the color of the leaf is always there. You just don't see it because the chlorophyll is green. So like when the chlorophyll goes away, it's similar to chlorophyll leaving the grass. It goes from, like grass is always that color. It's just the chlorophyll in the leaves is what gives it its green color. So as the chlorophyll retreats, you see what the color actually is.
Yeah. Like it's like masking all of that color, yeah, right?
Which I think is kind of yeah. cool.
So interesting. So everything is typically ugly, but chlorophyll helps a lot.
Chlorophyll gives us
I mean, I don't know that that's how a lot of people yeah. would call the New England
foliage. That almost sounded like it was going to be an inspiring quote. Like, hey, everything's ugly underneath. Like, wait, what?
Wait, what?
That's not, Sam. That doesn't make Sam. Me feel better. Everything's ugly underneath. You're just also ugly on the outside. Wait, Sam. No, you're hurting my feelings now.
Sorry. It's been a long week, okay?
So at this point that we're talking about, like in history, it's just like growing long, wild, and free, basically. Like that's what grass is, yeah. the green
yeah,
grass
exactly.
is.
It's yes. natural for livestock and nobody's using it as like, I'm going to have this as part of my landscaping garden and I'm going to trim it down to like an exact height of 1 inch all the time. Yeah, no, that's not a thing yeah. as of yeah. yet.
It just wasn't cultivated. They were using it in a different way. They were using it to get the seeds so that they could make mm-hmm. breads or oats or whatever.
Yeah.
That's sort of where we go next in the story is that because the people from Europe were bringing over their livestock, the native grasses were getting decimated because in the winter they didn't survive and the livestock didn't survive either because they had nothing to eat. And so the English brought over their own grasses to see if they would survive the winter. And we end up with all sorts of grass that now, you know, all of the dad memes associate with the United States, but Kentucky bluegrass is actually from Europe and the Middle East. And California turf grasses are from Spanish colonizers. So that's also why different parts of the United States have different grasses that are all not native to here. Like Bermuda grass is from Africa, and so is Guinea grass. So it's just, they're all from elsewhere,
yeah.
and they came here and brought their plants with them.
So somehow the European ones were just different and like hardier in the winter?
If you look at Europe on a globe, it's you'd be shocked how far north in latitude like Europe is. Yeah. So to me, it makes sense that these things would be able to survive there. But I don't have any sort of research that confirms that way.
Yeah. We didn't do specific research onto which species did well and why. But basically the research that I was able to find said that the native grasses couldn't compete with these new invasive species, which is a pretty common narrative anytime there's a new invasive species. And so as they brought over all of these new grasses, they started to spread and they would use them for whatever they wanted to use them for as they started to take over the land. But that's where we start to get into the colonization of this part of the globe by the Europeans and others that changed our culture as well. Not just the culture of the United States today, obviously, but like just it changed the culture of Europe. It changed the culture of the Americas. Because they became sort of started to separate and they started to copy each other in all these different ways. And that's when the French at the Palace of Versailles started to essentially take the pleasure garden to a whole new level and say, I'm not going to grow anything here. It's just going to be this small area of grass, which wasn't very big initially, but it like blew people's minds.
Mm-hmm. Just grass.
Just grass. There's no trees. There's no vines.
Yeah.
It's so funny because I feel like when I think about France, like when I think about Versailles, I don't think minimalist. Like I think very ornate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there is like a rich person's approach to minimalism too, of like, I have so much that I don't even need to get that.
Trace had a really interesting point when we recorded that made me think of things a different way. He said, it's the same thing with really high ceilings. Why do you need to have such a high ceiling? Well, it's just kind of a flex that, like, I can heat all of this useless air above me, you know? I can have this big, spacious place. I can afford to have a whole lot of nothing. And that's kind of the same statement that grass makes, especially for the French aristocracy.
Right. Rich people are fascinating.
I wonder, like, how did this shape, like, certain sports? Like, soccer couldn't really exist without grass. I don't know what other ones.
Yeah.
Tons of
any
them, right?
Kind of outdoor sports that people play today are probably were played in dirt patches if they existed at this time. And then they started to be played in grass, in part because grass has this natural ability, which we see on coastal environments, to hold the soil together, right? You don't have as much erosion because these little roots are spread throughout this soil, holding it together.
We do get eventually a specific person who is like the figure in revolutionizing gardens and inventing lawns.
Yeah, let me just say, the question was, who invented it? And so far, you now know where grass came from.
Right.
All of the different evolutions of it, how it got
to
the
new world. Invented grass.
Yeah.
We had to credit nature.
Start there. But otherwise, we've provided nothing of value for answering this question. But Trace, you want to talk about the king of gardeners?
Yeah, so obviously when the Palace of Versailles was, they were kind of landscaping it. They were using the landscape knowledge that they had at the time. And the king of gardeners is André Le Nôtre, who was born into a family of gardeners to the king. And he designed these ideas in gardening that we still use today, which is amazing. So forced perspective in gardening, for example. If you go look up a Palace of Versailles picture, it's these long, stretched out avenues of space. And the idea is it gives you this feeling of how big it is. But you can force those perspectives by making the path narrower as it gets further away from the palace, you know, stuff like that. Just like they do at Disneyland and stuff, to make things seem bigger than they are. And so we still use these today. He also invented this idea of creating moments of closed and open architecture in gardens, where you would walk through maybe a large topiary wall into something with a big tree in the middle, and it was enclosed. So you feel like you're in a different, completely different space, or you walk out of something like an archway into a big open space. And he turned these just big flat open areas into striking gardens. And that included this small bit of green carpet called the tapis vert, which was a way to say, again, I can grow nothing here, but the grass is soft and you can sit down on it and you can walk around on it. And that was just this indication of wealth and status. And as people visited, they started to be like, ooh, I need one of these.
This is nice. This feels nice to walk on.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, like speaking of things that like, could they have been invented without grass, when did the picnic start?
Yeah, exactly.
That's a great question. And what were ants doing before that?
Yeah.
It's a ratatouille situation, but with ants and Andre Le Nôtre.
That would be a great Pixar movie, like the ant who's like, I've got this idea, and no one in his colony believes
Andre
in him.
And
he's
ant.
Like, no, it's going to be great. And then he like finds the person.
Born in a family of gardeners, but he's like, I don't have the inspiration in me.
This one ant changes his life. This month on Disney Plus. Anyway.
Right. So André Le Nôtre's concepts of gardens are hugely influential to obviously the French aristocracy and also all the other aristocrats around Europe and beyond, right? Spain, Italy, Prussia, Austria, Russia. They're all like, I gotta get me one of these gardens. And they all, you know, design and landscape in similar ways. And of course, have paintings commissioned of what they're going to look like. And then over here in our little burgeoning colonies and later United States, we're seeing these images and we're also like, you gotta get me some of that. But as Trace will tell you, all paintings are fake.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah, all paintings.
Huh.
That's my favorite part about when I'm in DC going to the portrait gallery, take the tour, and the tour guide will tell you, like, no landscape in the portrait gallery is a real landscape. They're all like compilations of different landscapes put together, like, oh, I think it would be cool if there was a beautiful waterfall with this like stag standing in front of this pool with these trees. That place doesn't exist.
They're just aspirational.
Yeah, and they're all just manifesting, you know, they're just out there with vibes. And like, that's cool. As per usual in the US, we have this distorted view of what everybody else is doing. And so we want bigger, better, more incredible, and stuff like that. And so it just, we end up copying these ideas. And so in the US, the early United States, you had a working garden, like I was talking about earlier, with herbs and plants that were useful in the kitchen. And then as the richer people, you know, Thomas Jefferson went and saw the tapis vert and wanted one at Monticello. George Washington went and saw, and he wanted one at Mount Vernon. And so they just ended up bringing them over here into the American aristocracy, and making them bigger and more impressive in some ways because they didn't always see them in person. Some of them only saw them in paintings, and they wanted what they saw in the painting, even if it wasn't real.
And what was like the like rough time period of this?
So this would have been in the late 1700s, maybe mid 1700s. The first lawnmower, I can tell you that, came out in 1830. So prior to that, to maintain something like the Tapevere, you had to have people out there with literally like scythes, shears, if you wanted it very short. The first lawnmower was in England in 1830, and they got the idea from this local cloth mill where they would use a blade to trim the cloth and kind of shave it down and smooth it. Huh. But they use that on grass, and it's essentially the same as like a human-powered lawnmower that you would see now with like spinning blades that spin when you push them, I assume.
I'm just stuck on imagining someone on their hands and knees having to like cut individual blades of grass. Yeah.
That's the Downton Abbey that they don't show you, huh? And then as the USA grew into the 19th and early 20th centuries, now we get into the modern day of lawns. Julian, you want to jump on that?
Yeah. So, you know, when the cities were growing during Industrial Revolution and everything here, people are moving into urban areas and there's just not space for lawns. And then you have people in rural areas and they're still using what they've got as farms, right? And you've got tenant farmers and sharecroppers. Really, the explosion of the lawn in America takes place after the Second World War with the emergence of tract housing and the suburbs. You know, you've got all these GIs coming back and you've got suburbs springing up where they just make tons and tons and tons of like the same floor plans, models of houses, just mass producing them. And so now, if you can afford to move out of the city into one of these places and you've got all this land around you, but, you know, you're not a farmer, you probably work in the city, what are you going to use that land for? You're going to look to lawns. You're going to look to these ideals that you've seen in the past of, like, what do palaces have? What did, you know, the old American rich bigwigs, literally, like Jefferson, have, right? And they start popularizing lawns as we know them.
It made sense, like, oh, wealthy people are creating this lawn as a sign of, like, I can waste space. I never thought about, like, the rise of lawns is so deeply related to the rise of a middle class, this, like, aspirational kind of lifestyle where they're like, what's that next level of a thing that I can achieve?
Like, I made it to some degree because I have a lawn.
Bam. You got it. I've got the house, the white picket fence, and a lawn. Yeah.
And land that I grow nothing on.
Yeah.
And that's how we get to today, kind of. It's funny because lawns are associated with these things that, sort of to go back a little bit, are made up. You know, we believe that people who are wealthy had lawns, and so thus we wanted to have lawns. And we're holding ourselves to these ideals that aren't particularly old and don't really come from anywhere. You don't need a lawn. It's just a thing that we decided we should have at some point. You know, 18th century French aristocrats liked the look of a small bit of grass in front of their palace. And now we do that too, which just makes it feel sillier to me when you put it that way.
By the way, I'm sure people listening might be wondering, hey, why would a lawn or grass not be good for somewhere really hot and dry like a desert when you said that their photosynthesis is better adapted for drier climates? And it's true they are, but native plants to places like Southern California and deserts and stuff, they use a third different method of photosynthesis called CAM. I won't get into the specifics, but just know that that's even better and more suitable for the environment that we have than grass. So that's why native plants are still better for water consumption if you live in a place like Los Angeles or Las Vegas than a grass. So don't get go thinking like, oh, it's better than... No. Grass is still too water intensive for the environment here.
Scientific American posted that lawns require the equivalent of 200 gallons of drinking water per person per day in the U.S., and then NASA did a study in 2005 looking at lawns, just American lawns, and they found that there are more lawns than there are fields of irrigated corn by three times. That's how much more land space is dedicated to just growing nothing. I mentioned my mom earlier. Hi, Mom. She's a master gardener. And so I called her when I was doing the research for this to talk to her a bit about it. And she said, there's a big movement right now within the gardening community and within just people who do urban design to get rid of lawns, just to stop encouraging them. I think we've all felt it if you've been, if you've read about this space.
Yeah.
And they want to replace it with plants that are native, because native plants, as Julian mentioned, are better for water consumption for those regions, but also it's better for pollinators, because those native plants, you know, species like butterfly only often have one plant that they'll work with. They won't go and land on any flower. They'll only land on one flower and sometimes one species of flower. So you can't just swap in another one and the butterflies will be fine. And so those pollinators sometimes need those native plants. And having that movement to replace our lawns back to something that resembled the landscape before we started messing with it is big. It's growing, no pun intended.
That's fascinating. So who should we blame is the question that I have. Should we blame Pliny the Younger? Should we blame France generally? Should we blame World War II?
Always an easy one to blame.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the French aristocracy and say off with their heads.
Yeah, I feel like that's an easy blame since, you know, we've already sort of...
If only they invented some sort of efficient cutting machine that trimmed... For the lawn, I mean.
I ended our piece on our episode with this quote from Michael Pollan, which I heard years and years ago. He's the author of Omnivore's Dilemma, talks a lot about food and also eating plants and why that's important. But he wrote, "Lawns are nature, purged of sex and death. No wonder Americans like them so much." And the idea being that because we don't let the grass grow and give off seeds, it never gets to reproduce, but because it goes dormant in the winter, it doesn't ever die. We just don't let it breed with other grasses, and we also don't let it die. So it just we just keep cutting the tops off of it, and it just keeps trying to grow. And it's just, that makes it, I feel so bad for the grass now.
Yeah. I'm going to look at grass very differently for a lot of reasons, that being one of them.
Yeah. So interesting. Surprising how many things that... It's almost like tiny things
matter.
Make a big difference. Yeah, they matter. Kind of they matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, thank you guys. That was awesome. That's Absurd. Please Elaborate. It's a very fun podcast, not just to be a part of, but to listen to. So definitely check it out.
Please do. You can find us anywhere you get your podcasts. And you can also find us on our website if you want to ask a question. That'sabsurdshow.com/ask gets you right there. And you can listen on the website as well if you want.
Amazing. Well, thank you, guys. This was really fun.
We had a blast.
Next time you think about the lawn, you know, when you're walking around outside, think about what could be there instead and if that would be better.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say think of us.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Also think of us.
Around. Yeah. When you're walking around on grass.
Yeah. Pull up your podcast app.
When you're touching grass, think of us.
Yeah, who first touched
us? Oh. Wasn't Pliny the Younger, I'll tell you that much.
No.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Tiny Matters, a production of the American Chemical Society. My co-host is Sam Jones, who is also our executive producer. Our fact checker is Michelle Boucher, and the Tiny Matters theme and episode sound design are by Michael Simonelli and the Charts and Leisure team.
Thanks so much to Trace and Julian for joining us. Definitely head over to That's Absurd, Please Elaborate and subscribe. And if you have ideas for episodes or sciencey things that you just need to share, email us, tinymatters@acs.org. If you want another way to support the show, buy one of our spiffy coffee mugs. We have left a link in the episode description. You can find me on social at SamJScience.
And you can find me at OkidokiBoki. See you next time.